Blog Talk Radio.
I'm here.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, I have a special edition show with Dr. David Davin. We're going to talk about the state of healthcare in the United States. Dr. Davin is a sleep apnea specialist and pulmonologist in the Syracuse, New York area. And what he and I have been discussing before the show is going to knock your socks off, folks. We're in a precarious state these days, and I'd like to introduce Dr. Davin without any further ado. David, how are you tonight?
I'm doing okay, but as you and I were talking about before the show, I'm very frustrated with the status of American healthcare. To say that it's a system is to misstate the issue. It's really turned into just a highly reactive collection of stakeholders, and what's resulted is just the absolute intrusion and tainting of a sacred doctor-patient relationship by the people who control the system, and those are the people that hold the patient's money in their possession and incorrectly identify it as the insurance company's money. That is not the case. The dollars belong to the patient.
Gotcha. Well, let's back up a little bit, and when did things start to go wrong, and how are they today?
Well, I noticed in April of 2013, a patient of mine who had stopped smoking years ago came to me with a new onset of cough. He's a very smart guy, ran his own business for years, was very successful, and paid, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars to a very prominent local health insurance company. And with the new onset cough, he was justifiably worried as a former smoker that he might be developing lung cancer.
Mm.
This was in April of 2013.
Okay.
So we tried to get authorization from his health insurer for a CAT scan of his chest to see if, in fact, he was developing a cancer. And they denied authorization, which is to say that they just simply wouldn't pay for the CAT scan of the chest, even though I'm a board-certified pulmonologist and the patient had the classic reason for getting a CAT scan of the chest. And ultimately, we went through one layer after another of insurance company bureaucracy, and I ended up talking to a radiologist who wouldn't tell me whether he was sanctioned in any way, where he was located, whether he was still practicing or had retired 15 years ago. But he wasn't a clinician. He was a radiologist sitting in judgment of a patient whom he'd never seen, who was being cared for by a doctor with a skill set quite different from his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he simply, look, you know, I know these are the patient's premium dollars. The money is his, but I'm going to refuse to spend it on the CAT scan. And if the patient's that worried about his having a lung cancer, he can spend his own money. And,
oh, boy.
Right. And I even tried to get the patient to put a call through to this individual who worked for a company that is subcontracted by the health insurance company, and the doctor, the radiologist, refused to take the patient's call. So that was April of 2013. And since then, those episodes have become daily occurrences in our office. So instead of honoring the faith that people bring to us, we find ourselves having to fight tooth and nail with our insurers to get what they like to call authorization for either diagnostic tests or treatment or both. And
so in essence, they have no accountability to the patient in this instance. They're just throwing them to the wolves.
Absolutely. There is no accountability. There's only one state in the union, and that's Texas, where medical directors of health insurance companies can be held accountable for patient outcomes. So in New York and, you know, the other 49 states, the patient is really left to his own devices. And in many instances, as you know, people are paying upwards of $1,000 a month for health insurance premiums, and
right.
being denied diagnostic tests and or therapy. And that's what happened in this particular case. This patient had to pay for his own CAT scan out of pocket. Fortunately, he didn't have a lung cancer. But since then, what used to be a once or twice a week occurrence has become a two or three time a day occurrence. And most recently, I had a narcoleptic patient who was having dreadful side effects from a short-acting drug when I initially wanted to prescribe a long-acting drug for her. And I knew this would happen because I treat a lot of patients with narcolepsy, which is a disorder of constant sleepiness. And I created a note, and I faxed it to the private office of the medical director of the insurance company, who, by the way, specializes in HIV, an infectious disease, and is not in any way board certified in sleep medicine, credentialed in sleep medicine, or even qualified to practice sleep medicine.
That's crazy.
I found his private office on Long Island, and I got his fax number, and I just said, as of this date, he is accountable for this patient who is a hazard to herself and others because of the initial refusal to give long-acting Adderall, which is a combination of amphetamine salts. And I don't
Good
know
for
the
you.
Result is, yeah, but that has turned into a four or five time a day occurrence, just fighting tooth and nail to get your patients diagnosed or treated.
Which robs you of the time to spend with your patients and adds
well,
to their medical.
Not just the time, but you know, you have to concentrate. Patients are very complex, and diagnosis may look easy, but it's not. It's very difficult. You can't even blink. You can't take your eye off the ball for even a fraction of a second. And you always have to be ready to change posture because you could be wrong. You know, this is not House, where he looks out the eighth-story window, sees a patient get out of the rear right side of the car with a walker, declares that she's a Republican instead of a Democrat, and makes a diagnosis before she even gets into the hospital. That's not the way real medicine works. So it's not only a black hole of time and energy, it deprives me of the concentration that I need to accurately treat and diagnose patients. And in that way, it betrays the faith that the people place in me, and that's implicit in the doctor-patient relationship. So it's a travesty. It's a travesty, and I have yet to call, with one or two exceptions, to get authorization from somebody who was truly a peer, and that is somebody that was board certified in pulmonary medicine and sleep medicine. I remember talking to a doctor who had hired herself out to sit in judgment of requests for CAT scans and such, and she was asking stupid questions, you know, has the patient coughed up blood yet? Is the patient losing weight? You know, has the patient lost his appetite, et cetera, et cetera? This was another possible cancer case.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you've got to forgive me. I said, but the questions you're asking are the hallmarks of people with advanced cancer. I said, our goal is to make the diagnosis of a cancer before I would have to answer yes to any of those questions. Please tell me what your credentials are. And she said she was an obstetrician and a gynecologist.
Oh, my God.
And ultimately, she agreed to give the patient a CAT scan. And this ex-smoker, fortunately, did not have a lung cancer. And she said, listen, I want you to know that all I'm doing is following orders. And I said, well, I want you to know that that was the most common refrain at Nuremberg. And she said, you know, I've never been more insulted in my life. And I said, good, that was my intention. Thank you for the authorization. I'm going to give the numbers to my receptionist. I'm going to take care of this patient. Goodbye. That's
good
how
for
bad
you.
It is. That's
wow.
How bad it is.
Wow.
Wow. Wow is right. And
I mean, I'm speechless. I really am speechless.
When you regain your composure, I'll tell you Elizabeth's story.
I'm ready for it.
Okay.
I'm ready for it.
Elizabeth is a dear, dear lady going through sheer hell. She is the mother-in-law of another one of my patients whose wife died in her 40s of mesothelioma, which is an asbestos-induced cancer of the lining of the lung.
Okay.
And I asked Jim, the patient, I said, now, that's an exceedingly rare tumor, especially for a woman in her 40s. And it turns out that the patient, who's since passed away, along with two of her sisters, had a father that worked in construction. And he would come home every day with a work uniform just absolutely saturated with asbestos fibers. And his daughters wanted nothing more than at the end of the day to go with their dad to the local bakery and get a treat with him. And unknowingly, because this took place before 1977, he was basically inoculating his three beautiful daughters with asbestos. And there's a latency period of 20 to 30 years between the initial exposures and the development of the mesothelioma. But when I first met Elizabeth, Jim's mother-in-law, it was 2014. She had sleep apnea, and her request to me was, just keep me alive long enough so that I can see to it that each of my daughters dies pain-free and with dignity. And that was in 2014. A few months ago, this past summer, in fact, Elizabeth came to the office with a friend of hers. She had developed a tremor, probably had developed Parkinson's disease, and as such was unable, because she lives alone, to put her CPAP mask on. This prompted her home care company, not known for its altruism, to send a truck driver and a truck to her house to confiscate her CPAP machine for non-use for the past 60 days.
Oh, my God.
Right. They didn't call me. They didn't suggest a neurology consult. In fact, what they wanted to do was confiscate Elizabeth's CPAP machine and get her to sign a promissory note agreeing to pay the home care company if Medicare asked for some money back for those 2 months of CPAP usage. So Elizabeth came here with a friend. Obviously, Elizabeth is heartbroken, having buried at that time two of three daughters. The third one has since passed away, as I told you. Elizabeth came here with a friend who was under the impression that there was something that I, as a physician, could do. And I explained to them as graciously as I possibly could that I was utterly powerless in this scenario. And I dare say that if the patient's friend had had a weapon, I wouldn't be alive right now. She stormed out of the office. And the upshot of this is that Elizabeth has simply had it between trying to recover damages from the asbestos manufacturers and the construction company, and spent countless hours in courts and ICUs and going to Boston to get chemotherapy and surgery for her daughters. She simply turned in the CPAP machine, and with the contacts I have in the community, I got her another CPAP machine and a mask pro bono, and she just had enough. I just refused it, and she rejected my suggestion of a neurology consultation to treat what looked like Parkinson's disease. So that's the state of health care in America, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. That must have broken your heart.
Oh, it still does. It still does. People are dear to me. These are people who come to me with, they place faith in me. And I do everything I can to honor that faith. And who gets in the way? A perfect stranger interfering with my ability to deliver care. So we can get a few calls, I would suggest. How about that? I've monopolized a lot of time.
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm intrigued and I'm horrified.
Horrifying.
You know,
there's
there are no other words for it. And intrigue isn't correct, except that it's compelling to listen to these stories, and it's unimaginable that this could be what's going on behind the scenes.
What happens in every doctor's office. Every day, every week, every month, it happens in every emergency room. It happens to hospitalized patients. And the insurance companies act as if the money they're controlling is their money. It's not. It belongs to the patients, whether it finds its way into the insurance company's hands via the employer or directly from the patient. But
what recourse,
Benny,
do the patients have? Where can they go to take their plight to the quote-unquote insurance system?
They can call the number on their insurance card and try to talk to a medical director, and they will not be put past a telephone operator, even though they're paying the medical director's salary with their premiums. That's how toxic and how unconscionable the so-called system has become, and it's a battle we fight every day.
Well, let me ask this then: who are the insurance? If the insurance companies aren't accountable to the patients, who are they accountable to? Where can the patients go to make the insurance companies accountable to them?
Nobody.
Do they have to? Legislators or what?
Well, each state has a health insurance department, and the patient can go and take on that bureaucracy, okay? But the insurance companies have an interesting position of power. They have huge amounts of money left at the end of every year. They have CEOs that are making 7 and 8 figures and getting huge bonuses. And everybody who works in the insurance company down the food chain just looks the other way. And as that gynecologist told me, she said, look, I'm just following orders. you know, and as I said, if you look at the footage of the Nuremberg trials, that was the single most common refrain. I was just following orders.
I remember that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I remember hearing that.
I can't say I'm an expert on World War II history, but for a lot of reasons, it's something that I've studied. And, you know, I pay attention to these sorts of things. I ask patients to call their health insurer, and in every instance, they never get past the phone operator.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And it's about time that the public awakened to this. One should make the argument that, say, for holding money in reserve, the insurance company should not have an extra nickel available at the end of the year. Because,
well, I'm sure this is news to most people, and probably the ones that are making the phone calls are the ones with the really dire needs.
Right.
And that's premium, a fraction of the populace.
Right.
So
the premiums every year, and payments to providers go down every year. Follow the money. Follow the money.
Mm.
You know, so there's got to be somebody out there listening that has had an experience similar to what I've described.
Yeah. Well, if there is anybody that's listening tonight live, please press 1 to speak with Dr. Davin and share your experience. Unfortunately, the case with internet radio is that most people listen to the shows on podcasts.
I see.
We may or may not have anybody listening live. That I don't know. I don't have that information available to me unless somebody actually presses 1 and gets into the caller's queue. But
let's talk about another travesty, hospital errors are now the third leading cause of death in the United States.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. In October of 2013, a lot of very legitimate groups published data that documented that there are 440,000 Americans dying annually from preventable hospital errors. 440,000 annually, and that comes to, if anybody's interested in the math, that comes to 1,205 people a day. The last time the numbers were looked at was Y2K, to use an old phrase, and the Institute of Medicine and the National Institutes of Health published data that said that there were 100,000 preventable deaths in hospitals every year. There was a hue and cry. Nobody could believe it. So all of the data was turned over to another group of statisticians, actuaries, et cetera. And yes, that 100,000 per year figure was wrong. It was actually 200,000 per year when they relooked at it in 2001. And it's now more than doubled. It's 440,000 people yearly.
Is that because hospitals are understaffed?
Well, you know, there's never one reason. We're talking about complexity here, complexity science, what are known as complex adaptive systems that have
right.
the capacity to develop self-criticality. And those terms may resonate with some people who are listening. They may be foreign, but we're talking about exceedingly complex systems where all it takes is one omission or commission to be transferred to a series of subsystems. And as it gets transferred, it gets amplified, and the result is nonlinear and exponential, and it's typically a patient's death. And one of the examples that comes to mind, 10 or 12 years ago, a young lady from Latin America needed a heart transplant, and she was flown from her village in Latin America to Durham, North Carolina. and she was put on the list for a heart transplant, which she in fact got. And the entire healthcare system down there did a splendid job. Everybody swung into action. They found a donor, but very, very early on in the narrative, somebody forgot to notice that the patient's blood type did not match the donor's blood type. The most basic omission, the most basic error that could possibly have occurred, not only occurred, but nobody picked up on it until the third or fourth post-operative day, when, for reasons nobody could understand, this patient started rejecting her transplanted heart. And then it became clear that the blood bank, the organ procurement agency, et cetera, everybody had neglected to reconcile the patient's blood type with the donor's blood type. And I remember the heart surgeon owning all of this, crying, weeping openly at a press conference and saying, look, you know, I could blame this on some underling in the blood bank or somebody in the organ procurement system, but I'm the surgeon, and it was my responsibility to make sure before I put a scalpel to that patient's chest that the blood types matched. This is the first time that had ever happened at Duke. The patient got a second heart transplant, but she ultimately died. And that's what I mean by seemingly small errors, perturbations, fears.
Well, that's not an exact small error.
Well, it's a clerical issue, frankly.
Yeah.
It's not like putting somebody on a heart-lung machine and opening their chest and keeping them alive for 7 to 12 hours with an artificial heart. You know, it's not that. It's a clerical omission that by the time the patient made it to the operating room, had her chest open, and there's a donor heart sitting in preservative solution, at that point, that clerical omission becomes a catastrophically exponential error, and it resulted in the patient's death. And people can Google that up. I looked at it recently. You know, the stories are legion. Legend. And you can just look up heart transplant death at Duke University, and you can find this out for yourself. So that's a tragedy, and you know it's a very glaring tragedy. But there are other errors as well. And 440,000 deaths a year, 1,200 people a day, it is simply unacceptable.
And these are all preventable deaths.
All preventable deaths. I mean, I'm looking at Google right now. I made a point to be in my sleep laboratory when we had this discussion, so I would have a computer in front of me, and I just typed in preventable deaths in healthcare, and of course Google came up with 8,680,000 results.
Wow.
So this is information available to anybody. So when you take that and you throw in the absolute perversity of health insurers just refusing to honor the patient's faith in them, what you end up with is what we've got, and that's a hopelessly broken healthcare apparatus. You can't call it a system. It's basically a competing stakeholders. And the regulations, the audits, everything are just unbelievable. It's so hard to practice medicine now. Disease has no longer become the primary enemy. It's the various stakeholders that are the enemies.
And this is the United States we're talking about.
This is not the Soviet Union of 1975 or 1980. This is 2015 United States of America. And, you know, the denial of authorization on the part of health insurers and the number of preventable deaths and hospitals are two huge gorillas that just go undealt with. And there's so much fraud and abuse being perpetrated by everybody from members of my profession, much to my everlasting shame, to home care companies. It's ridiculous. And those of us who do an honest job, who care about our patients, are having our energy and our time and our staff time usurped just by trying to get the patient the right drug or the right test. You know, meanwhile, the patient, if I put a call into a doctor's office, it's a simple matter. Well, it isn't, because if we phone in a prescription to a pharmacy and we find out that that inhaler or whatever the case may be is not going to be paid for, then the patient is stuck paying out of pocket. And in the instance of some asthma medications, that could be hundreds of dollars per inhaler.
Right.
So it's not trivial. It's not trivial. So anyway, I don't know if anybody's called in, but you know, those are three huge issues. Health insurance, denying authorization, preventable medical deaths, and fraud and abuse. And to say that the problems are rampant is an understatement.
Well, I will let you know if we have any callers. It floors me. I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. I certainly have had my own experience with doctors that have advocated for me for testing and have told me how difficult it is to get things done. And these were not for life-threatening situations. And in all cases, it came through for me. But to think in terms of people whose lives are literally on the line, that they're denied basic human dignity, if you will, to address very serious health, life-threatening health concerns, it's beyond me.
Right. Most people view what I just said with disbelief, unless they happen to have gone to a doctor's office and been denied authorization. And then what the companies will do, they'll insist on a peer-to-peer review. And only on one or two occasions, maybe three out of hundreds, have I actually talked to a pulmonologist or a sleep specialist. Most of the time, I'm talking to a retired GP or a gynecologist or an orthopedic surgeon. And they always work for a consulting company that's subcontracted by the health insurer. So the health insurer has plausible deniability. So it's a disaster, Dave. It's just an abject disaster, and I don't see it getting any better. It's getting worse.
Is there any hope? Is there any recourse?
Well, of course there is recourse, okay? You know, we have a government. We have a Congress. We have legislators who claim that they want to act for the greater good. Let's have them do it, because when you come right down to it, we are each other's only hope. And if the profit margins of health insurers are placed above the interests of a doctor-patient relationship, then you've tainted and ruined a millennia-old tradition of a privileged, confidential relationship of trust and faith. And patients are putting their faith in their health insurer as well. So it's quite appalling.
Well, I don't know if there's anything else that you want to discuss tonight, or if you feel like we've made adequate points for people to digest and see what kind of feedback might come back. I leave that to you. If there's anything else that you'd like to discuss that's related to this, more power to you.
I would just have patients really explore who's accountable for their health care. You know, when they go to the pharmacy counter with a prescription and they're paying $1,100 or $1,200 a month in health insurance premiums, and they're going to the pharmacy counter with a prescription written by a doctor who has a license and good standing, and that prescription gets denied, we get a call back at this office. Well, what's a substitute drug? Then we have to find out, you know, what the insurance company authorizes, and typically they authorize the low bid item. And drug companies, of course, are not in the habit of decreasing their prices. So the health insurers would say, wait a minute, you know, the drug companies are responsible. They keep raising their prices. So we have to do what we do. And who's caught in the middle? The doctor and the patient. I don't see the situation getting any better, quite frankly, absent really, really draconian legislation to prevent this sort of thing. Absolutely.
Well, we do have a caller.
Good.
Her name is Diana. She happens to be a nurse.
Hi, Diana.
Former nurse. Let me bring her on the line. It's taking a minute. Diana, hi, how are you tonight?
Hi, David. I just tuned in, so I don't know who's talking or what
you've
been
talking. It's too bad. It's been quite a show. I have Dr. David Davin presenting tonight, and he has painted a picture that's very dark and ominous as far as the state of the doctor-patient relationship being compromised by the health insurance companies, and also talked about preventable death in the healthcare system vis-a-vis the hospitals. There are 1,200 people a day that are dying in hospitals, deaths that could have been prevented, and then there's the third part has been the fraud that's perpetrated by health insurance companies and even doctors and home care agencies, that kind of thing. So it's been quite a scintillating show. But please say hello to Dr. Davin.
Hi, Diana. Where are you working as an RN right now?
No, I retired in 2009. I just it didn't resonate with my soul any longer. The things that we're doing.
What a phrase. Did you work in an office or a hospital or some?
No, I worked in a hospital. I was on the front lines.
Yeah. You know what takes place. You see the failures.
Oh, exactly.
You see the complexity. And I had a patient that was just in the hospital recently. And, of course, everything now is electronic medical records.
Right. It was then, too.
Right. And the patient's doctor was very, very frustrated because he was trying to type in orders from his office across the street to the hospital to go to the nursing floor, which was the surgical floor, for the patient to get medications for antibiotic-induced colitis, to have the diet advanced, et cetera, et cetera. And the system was, to use a familiar phrase, down. So none of the orders could get communicated. And when they finally did, of course, there was anywhere between a 2 and a 3 hour lag time between the time the order got sent down to the pharmacy and the medication made it up to the patient.
Right.
And these sorts of delays, I'm sure, are very, very familiar to you. The nurses on the floor ended up telling the patient, look, I'll go down to the pharmacy and pick up the antibiotic if they just tell me when it's ready. I'll literally walk, you know, the half a block or the block that it would be to go from one building in a hospital to another, pick up the medication so that the patient can get it. But these types of delays, I'm sure, were very, very common if you worked in a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And patients don't realize that these delays can really result in bad outcomes, very bad outcomes. And then lots of times, as you well know, as a nurse, patients get admitted, and they get admitted with a diagnosis that has a certain DRG value associated with it. So the hospital's going to get paid X whether the patient stays the 3 or 4 days that are allowed by the DRG or whether the patient stays for 6 or 7 days. And if the patient stays for an extra 3 or 4 days, then basically the hospital is working for nothing for those extra 3 or 4 days, which is blaming the hospital for the patient's illness. And so hospitals are having to react to that situation, just as my practice, which has 7 people working for 1 doctor, has to react to the fact that we literally have to fight to get extended release Adderall for our narcoleptic patients as opposed to the short-acting Adderall, which causes all types of problems. And trying to get Provigil, modafinil, to treat a narcoleptic is asking an impossibility. In many instances, the insurance companies just simply deny that. So, you know, these are all familiar scenarios to you, I'm sure.
Well, the doctors really aren't allowed to practice anymore. They're practicing under government regulations.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, that's part of when I quit, when the critical paths became. They weren't really critical. They were government regulations. And if the doctor didn't order a certain set of stuff or give the medicine they wanted the doctor to give, then the pharmacist was supposed to tell on them, and they could get time off without pay. It was ridiculous that
right.
What medical doctors became. And nurses just had to do whatever the pharmacy said as well. So, and
one of the stories that I told Dave before you came online help me out, Dave. I'm just drawing a blank. It wasn't the lady with the mesothelioma.
Is it the one about Elizabeth? Or
it wasn't about Elizabeth. It was about the OBGYN doctor I plead with to get a CT of the chest, Diana, and a patient, an ex-smoker, with a new onset cough, who was worried appropriately that he had developed a lung cancer. So after we went through layer after layer of clerks and minions at the insurance company, they claimed they were going to give me what was a peer-to-peer discussion. So here I am as a pulmonary doctor, worried that my patient has a cancer in the chest, and I'm talking to somebody on the phone who sounds like a medical student reading off of a list. And she's saying things like, well, has your patient coughed up blood yet? I said, no.
Yeah, that's part of what I want.
Right.
I'm not resonating with my soul any longer. You're not allowed to take your patients. And I really didn't realize that it had gotten that bad for the pulmonary doctors. I thought they were still allowed to make decisions. So that went all the way up, even to the specialists.
Well, after the third question, you know, has the patient lost weight? Has the patient coughed up blood? Does the patient have bone pain? I said, look, stop. What are your credentials? I need to know what your credentials are, because this is what we're trying to prevent. we're trying to make this diagnosis of a lung cancer before any of these clinical outcomes occurred. And she told me that, you know, she was an OBGYN working for a company that I'm not going to name, that's subcontracted by a lot of insurers across the country. And she, after I did a little teaching over the phone and explained to her that we were trying to prevent this patient from worsening, she said, listen, I just want you to know all I'm doing is following orders. And my rejoinder was, well, that was the most common refrain at Nuremberg. And she said, I've never been more insulted in my life. And I said, well, that was my intention. You took an oath. You took an oath. Thank you for the authorization numbers. I'm going to say goodbye now. And I basically hung up on her. But that's what we
Well, you planted
with.
A seed that day, David. You planted a seed, and that's what we all need to do as we go through our daily lives, no matter what injustices that we encounter. When we plant seeds, they eventually will hopefully bear fruit, you know. And,
well, Dave, I'd like to say that you're right. You know, you and I know each other pretty well, and I think we both realize that we are each other's only hope. But right now, patients are pitted against their own insurance companies.
That I understand.
Since the doctor turns out to be the most visible part of the system, and the nurse,
right.
As Diana will attest, they are the target for the patient's anger.
Right.
Not deservedly so, which is why Diana said she had to quit in 2009 because it no longer resonated with her, which is a wonderful phrase, Diana. Absolutely wonderful.
Oh, with my soul. There was just too much for me to forgive myself for every day, the things we had to do to patients.
Right, right.
It just, and I could tell, like, if there was a medical doctor like you who cared about the patient, they couldn't get anything done.
No.
And if you were holistic, like I was Worcester Holistic, I was like, let's get rid of her. Let's give her the worst patients. Let's wear her out because she's older. You know, I had been a nurse for 30 years by then. I was ready to quit.
Right.
But it was to see the change from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and then 2000. It was too much.
After 9/11, we were all supposed to be warm and fuzzy and friendly and treat each other with kindness and compassion. And now, frankly, you realize that there is no lie that somebody won't tell if there's money to be gotten. And healthcare, last time I checked, is accountable for about 18% of the gross domestic product. So you're talking about trillions of dollars. You know, 1.4 trillion is an old number. So by now it's probably 1.6 trillion. But let's just round it off and say that healthcare expenditures are responsible for 18 to 20% of the gross domestic product. You're talking about, you know, ungodly amounts of money in an era where you know, somebody who's really clever with the internet can make $1 million in a morning. You know, nobody cared that you were literally shedding tears over the obstacles put in your way to care for your patients. And nobody cares that my staff literally is ready to jump out of its skin at the end of the day because we've been denied authorization 12 times for drugs or tests or, you know, important tools to care for patients. So,
this was not ran by somebody who cared what seeds. They would see a good person as somebody they had to get out of the way. That's just what they would understand what it was like. Like I was told, don't talk to your patients. Tell them you'll be back in an hour, but don't talk to them. Don't let them talk to you because then, you know, I was being forced not to take care of my patients, but take nine patients that I couldn't take care of. And all the meds came up late. And if you could pull this computer around for 12 hours, then stay overtime 2.5 hours to chart everything you did and not make a mistake, you might get 6 hours of sleep to come back for another 13 hours of frontline. So you didn't
right.
get break. They didn't really care, and that, you know, and the doctors didn't have time to care about what the problems the nurses were having. But I was just adding to whatever you had already told David. So what if there is any possible thing, it might just be that you yourself have to learn magic.
Well, you know, as you know, if you were
admitted
to the hospital, God forbid, tonight, you know, for what my patient was admitted for a week or so ago, antibiotic-induced colitis, okay, you know as a nurse that you would have a loved one or a significant other there making sure that you got your Flagyl, that you got your Cipro, that you got your IV protonics, that your IV was running, you know, that your diet was advanced appropriately, because you know the delays. Just by way, I'm in my sleep lab right now, and I went to CMS.gov, and you guys will be interested in this. It says U.S. healthcare spending grew 3.6% in 2013, reaching $2.9 trillion. So it's no longer $1.4, it's 2.9.
Wow.
$9,255 per person, and as a share of the gross domestic product, health spending accounted for 17.4%. $2.9 trillion is a lot of dollars, David.
Yeah.
A lot of dollars.
It's beyond my ken.
Yeah. What Diana is telling you mirrors my experience perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for...
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How do you mitigate the stress connected to this? How in heaven's name do you manage to survive as almost a pawn in the system? I mean, ultimately it's the patient, but you're the advocate. You're the physician. What do you do to take care of yourself?
That's a great question. I'm sure Diana can relate to this. Are you still on the phone, Diana?
Yeah, I'll let you answer that first. I have one story with that answer that David might be interested in.
Yeah,
sure.
What I tell my patients is that at the end of the day, I'm like the guy in Terminator 2. There's puddles of me all over the office floor. And somebody comes by with a straight edge and scrapes those little puddles together and forms a human being with a conscience. But it's excruciating. And I try to find reliable sources of beauty anywhere I can find them. How about you, Diana? What did you do?
Well, when it got to that point, and I did try to teach a class, and I tried to make a position of being, because I was board certified holistic. That is a 6-hour board at the bachelor's, master's degree level. Not
yes.
just a week seminar.
It's not trivial.
So
yeah.
I offered to, if they would make a position where staff could come down and get relaxation training, acupressure, you know, I even had the machines, the ultrasonic machines, and infratonic 8, which was a good one for stress relaxation. You put it on your heart, the deep breathing, anything that would have them, let them come down and just get some relaxation. And they basically told me, you're not really a nurse anymore.
Right.
You're a healer, and we don't want healers to be in hospitals because it's a business. So
it's
they didn't
business.
Even want their staff to stay well. To make a position to pay a nurse for 4 hours at a time to take care of staff, they did not want that. And
no.
they took the time to tell me that I wasn't a nurse anymore. I was a healer now. And,
right.
you know, and I was up for a promotion, and, of course, I couldn't get it because I was a healer. And, It was mostly the PAs, I have to tell you, that were against me once I got certified.
Are put in a tenable position. PAs are meant to carry out orders after diagnoses are established. And some of the most egregious errors I've seen in diagnosis have been made by PAs who are placed in a position that would challenge even an experienced physician in terms of diagnosis, which diagnosis is a very, very slippery business. And you have to be prepared to change footing in a heartbeat because you can be wrong. And, you know, you can put together, as you know, Diana, from your experience, you can sit in rounds, make rounds with your doctor's team on a Monday, come up with what sounds like an absolutely brilliant diagnostic and treatment plan on Monday. And by Wednesday, everybody's looking at one another and saying, what ignoramus thought this up? And it turns out that I was the ignoramus. You know, and if you invest yourself emotionally in the diagnosis and egotistically in the diagnosis and you refuse to change course, what you wind up with is a dead patient.
Refusal to change. And that did happen. I have to tell you the truth. That was another reason it didn't resonate with my soul any longer.
Right.
If you called the doctor and said, this person needs to be in ICU, and not yesterday, and not when you come in 8 hours, they need to be in ICU right now. And
right.
they just fiddle fart around, for lack of what else to say. My dad used to say that. And
I
patient,
love fiddle
I can
farting.
Keep them alive
because
of the
same.
Angels. We can keep them alive till day shift, but day shift has a hard time getting them to ICU then. Because I was a night shift nurse.
Well,
but most people, they just fell through if somebody didn't pay attention to them when they said, doctor, this patient should be in ICU. They really should be.
You can imagine my position when a patient with severe sleep apnea and a body mass index of 40, normal being 25, comes to me for preoperative clearance for a total hip replacement, cervical spine surgery, you know, big operations. I go to incredible lengths. I give the patient their sleep studies. I give them a copy of the note. I fax it to the surgeon, the primary care doctor, the advanced registration and testing center. And I give the patient a cautionary note that says that they're cleared, but everybody has to pay very careful attention perioperatively, before, during, and after, to upper airway stability. And I jokingly tell the patients, look, when the janitor comes in the room to clean the floor, hand him a copy of this note. Make sure everybody knows that you have sleep apnea. And if someone gives you patient-controlled analgesia post-op, they're putting you at risk, and you need to be in an intensive care unit, not on an orthopedic floor. And we go through that, probably several times a week with surgical clearances for people with obstructive sleep apnea. A familiar scenario to you, no doubt.
Well, they will put them on the floor and just give them the BPA, what was the name of that sleep apnea treatment? Not the...
CPAP.
CPAP, yeah, and then have respiratory check on them every 4 hours, but that's all respiratory can do. So just because respiratory checked on them and the nurse was juggling nine patients, two of them could have been getting blood, one could have been having a kidney stone, you know, really busy, busy patients.
Right.
And just because respiratory therapy came and put their name on a board and ran to do something else didn't mean that they got better care. But for they got better care.
Belong in a respiratory care unit. There's no question about it. No question about it.
Well, folks, we're coming up to the end of the hour here, and, you know, instead of doing my usual closing, since this has been such a serious show, I would be moved, were it not to have dead space on the airwaves, to have a moment of silence. But instead, David, I'm going to ask you if there's any closing statements you would like to make. And Diana, thank you for calling in. It's been great to have you dialogue with Dr. Davin, And David, thank you so much. I really appreciate your input and the consciousness that you've raised tonight.
Well, I'm just going to restate what I said earlier, and that is that we are each other's only hope. And we now live in a nation which, as you know, is more polarized than it's ever been at any time in my lifetime. We are polarized along every axis conceivable. And unless we understand that we are each other's only hope, this situation is only going to get worse. And the engine that's driving it is greed and money. And somebody's got to realize that. Somebody's got to realize that, put a stop to it, and stop healthcare insurers from intruding upon a sacred relationship based on faith and trust. And that's not just the faith in the doctor. It's the faith that the patient has that their health insurer is going to live up to their commercials and honor them, honor their trust, and make sure that they get the best care that they and their doctor have decided upon. Diana, I'll turn it over to you if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah. Well, I think that this doctor needs some care himself, too. He's at that point where he's leaking his spirit everywhere. So if you wanted to come back to the show on the night I'm on and we could spend some time helping you get your spirit intact, get your all these pieces of your spirit that you're leaking out and all these problems, bring them all back to yourself. You know, just that you take your power back. We can
thank you very much.
That.
When I leave my lab shortly in a few minutes, I'm going to go home and pick up my guitar and play some music, which I find just tremendously healing. I was listening to old 70s Springsteen tonight while I was doing interps. And the other thing I'm going to do is work on my novel. I have a novel in front of an agent right now. David knows that story. And I'm going to go home and lose myself in that fiction. And I find both of those, both music and writing, to be tremendously healing. But you're right, the toll that it takes on me is excruciating, absolutely excruciating, Diana. That's a very astute observation on your part. Because I took an oath, and I refuse to betray the faith that patients put in me. I just absolutely refuse to do it, as you did.
Well,
as you did.
Heroes have to be taken care of. Okay,
right.
I'll sign up because I know David's got to go. I'm so glad I at least got in on this. Thank you.
Hey,
well,
we
thank
are
you,
too.
Diana. I always appreciate your input. And, David, you know, I just want to say to the statement you made, amen, and go for it. You know, you have got what it takes, and we don't have enough doctors like you out there. And God bless you. Thank you for being on the show tonight.
Unfortunately, Dave, I hear that so often that it's heartbreaking how rare I truly am. And that really breaks my heart. So
sure.
I'm going to say goodbye to everybody and hang up the phone. Is that what I'm supposed to do, Dave?
That's what we're going to do. We're just going to call it the end of the episode and some food for thought, some very serious food for thought. And I wish everybody a good night and God bless. God bless us all.
Thank you both. Good night to both of you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.